director of the Francois Xavier Bagnot Center for Health and Human Rights and professor of Health and Human Rights, Harvard School of Public Health, Dr. Jim Yong Kim. Regional representative, former executor, director, CFW Shops, Academy for Educational Development, Lisa Kimbo. Director, 50 by 15 Initiative, Advanced Micro Devices, Dan Schein. And our moderator, President, PATH, Dr. Chris Elias.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. I hope you're all awake after lunch. This is a very exciting panel. I've had an opportunity to talk to our panelists before we got started, and we have a very interesting mix. The title of the panel is New Hope and Tools for Strengthening Health Systems. And to show you what that takes, it's not surprising that we have a former Minister of Health, one of the world's leading medical anthropologists, a micro-franchise entrepreneur, and someone who makes computer chips, because it's going to take a little bit of each of those things to make this happen. Let me, before we start, remind you that during this first half hour, you should be thinking of questions that we may not get to in our panel discussion, and give them to your moderators at your table so that they can send them in. During the second half of the second part of the program, while you're having your table discussions, we'll discuss those questions with the panelists and come back in the third part ready to address some of those so that we can talk about your specific questions as well. I won't go through any bios for Julio or Jim Kim. They're in your books. But I just want to say a couple of words about Lisa and Dan since the program has changed since it went to publication. Lisa was born and raised in Kenya, has a BS degree in finance. She started her career in banking and was head of the Division for Business Support at Standard Chartered Bank in Kenya, where she specialized in strategic planning and the bank's business divisions. She then started a private retail pharmaceutical and distribution company with an annual turnover of over $100 million. And then for the last 7 years has worked on establishing a very innovative model of essential healthcare delivery, CFW Shops, which is a franchise model program that currently operates 64 health outlets in 10 districts in Kenya and has provided for over 1 million treatments for community members. Dan Schein has agreed to step in for Hector Ruiz, the CEO of AMD, who was supposed to be here and was delayed at the last minute. Dan's the director of the Global 50 by 15 initiative, and I'll ask him in a second to tell you a little bit about that. With more than 15 years of experience in internet mobile applications and rich digital media, and senior roles in global development, marketing, alliances, strategy, and evangelism. Dan's held positions at Motorola and Walt Disney Imagineering as well as at AMD. So let's move right into our panel. Let me start with Julio by asking perhaps what some may think is an obvious question, but which I think would get a lot of answers. What are health systems from the perspective of a former Minister of Health?
The health system is the organized social response to health challenges. So every society has a health system. And something that's very important to understand is that the population is part of the health system. The health system is not something that's outside. People participate as patients with needs, as consumers with demands, as citizens with rights demanding, and as co-producers of health. So the health system is the set of organizations, including people's organizations and specialized institutions, that mobilize resources to generate health services to ideally produce an output. An outcome, which is improvement in health. The one law we have about health systems is that if you compare countries with exactly the same income and exactly the same level of expenditure in health per capita, there's huge variation across countries in the way their health systems perform. So let me say that we talk a lot in these meetings about magic bullets, specific technologies. Well, the health system is the magic gun that you need to shoot the bullet. And we need to understand two common misconceptions is to see health systems as a black box that we can't understand. We need to open it and we can intervene. And by comparing, know why some health systems do so much better than others. The other misconception, apart from the black box, is the black hole. No one wants to invest because, you know, we see this as something that just will go in salaries to doctors and nurses. It doesn't need to be like that. Some health systems are much better than others.
Great. Just a quick follow-up question. We've heard a lot in previous sessions in Global Health about vertical and horizontal programs. Can you just say a word about whether that thinking is helpful to us as we think about health systems?
That has been one of the most divisive ways of thinking in public health, and it has split the public health community. Hope everyone knows what we're talking about. Vertical programs that focus on specific diseases like HIV/AIDS or tuberculosis or malaria or child health or particular programs. Horizontal that focuses on the health system but without a clear sense of priorities. I think we need to extend the geometric metaphor and search for the diagonal. The diagonal is the way of integrating the vertical with the horizontal, and that means using clear priorities that are pro-poor, that focus on the priority needs for the poor, to drive generic improvements into the health system. That's the diagonal thinking that we need now.
Thanks, Julio. Great opening. Jim, you and your colleague Paul Farmer at Partners in Health are arguably some of the rock stars of the global health field. My daughter just went off as a freshman to college, and like many freshmen in colleges across the country, her required reading over the summer was Mountains Beyond Mountains. We've heard a lot about the Partners in Health experiences and the general media, et cetera. I wonder if you could tell us concisely a little bit about the model, and to what extent do you think it's replicable and scalable?
Well, at Partners in Health, we've started about 20 years ago. And back in those days, global health was really a very small community. One of the leaders of it, Alan Rosenfield, is here today. But there weren't very many of us who were doing it. And we decided that we would take a very specific approach. We decided that what we would do is to focus on very specific communities and then try hard to push the boundaries of what people thought was possible in terms of delivery of healthcare. So we took on problems like drug-resistant TB at a time when the World Health Organization said it's impossible to treat it in developing countries and just leave it alone. We also took on HIV treatment in 1998 before anyone thought very seriously, other than in Brazil, that it would be something that you could treat in developing countries. So that's been our model. We've been trying to focus on expanding the boundaries to expand the resources that would come into this space. Well, now the resources have expanded dramatically. So now scale is our primary focus, and we are in Rwanda, part of President Clinton's wish from TED. We're working on trying to scale up primary health care that will utilize all the energy and resources that have come into the country from the TB, HIV, and malaria money. We're trying to precisely go down that diagonal. Now, in order to do that, I've been looking around to try to find out, well, who are the masters of implementation, delivery, scale? And, you know, in the public health and medical world, we don't get very much of that. So I ended up at Harvard Business School, and I'm now under the tutelage of Mike Porter, who's here, who will be moderating the next session, trying to learn from the business school, how do we capture experience? How do we build analytic frameworks that can teach us about scale-up and make it more than a slogan? Julio's done it. Julio scaled health insurance programs. He scaled cash transfer programs. But so much of that information, unfortunately, exists in Julio's head. What we need to do is capture experience very, very broadly, look at it with the lens that experts in management, operations, implementation would look at it, and then try to spread that kind of understanding of scale as broadly as we possibly can. And we're trying to do that now at Partners in Health.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Lisa, tell us a little bit about the business model of CFW Shops.
I think it's timely because we've just been talking about scale, to talk about the franchised outlets. About 7 years ago, we started up the CFW Shops franchise outlets in Kenya. And the idea behind franchising of healthcare was really looking at the community and trying to determine what were the challenges to access to essential healthcare at the community level. And we figured that if you could have, at the community level, an outlet for healthcare, that is sustainable, where you have a qualified health worker, you know, providing the essential package, the essential drugs and supplies that are needed, that you could really have an impact and address the needs of the community. We also looked at what kind of model that you can you work with that would go to scale, that, you know, can be applicable across, you know, very many different communities. And looking at those various challenges, we decided to pilot a franchise system. And essentially what it is we work with nurses, and we get nurses who come from the communities that are looking to be served and train them. They come to us already trained. We train them. We set up a franchise system with the training modules, basically look at business systems. They look at drug management. They look at client management. And they look at, you know, community interventions that is outside of the facility. We arrange a microloan for the franchisee, who is the nurse. And though the organization provides training and all the backup systems, the franchisee has to take a microloan that covers the products that are in her outlet. So this is set up as a for-profit business. The franchisee earns a living from what they do, which is to provide essential health care at the community. We use a franchise methodology because it is a proven business methodology. I understand in the U.S. today, over 60% of all new businesses that are starting up as a franchise. Franchising is proven and it's known to work. And why does it work? It takes away the risk for the entrepreneur because they're coming into a system where a lot of the methodologies have already been, you know, tried and tested. It involves standards, you know, setting. It involves uniformity of systems. And so a nurse can set up a clinic using a franchise system within her community and be pretty much assured that she has the support and backup of an organization that will lead her, you know, to success. And this we have done over 7 years and have worked now, are now working in about 10 districts and set up 64 outlets.
Great. Just a quick follow-up, concise answer. Often in meetings on global health, we spend the day talking about government programs, et cetera, and there's a session at the end where it says, what's the role of the private sector? Mm-hmm. What I want to do is turn that around and say to a successful private sector entrepreneur, what's the role of the public sector in supporting the success of CFW shops and models like it?
Thank you. When we set out to set up the CFW shops model, for example, working with nurses, we pretty much assumed that we would get a lot of support from the public sector for, you know, to do this because there's such a need. You've got all these communities. You've got statistics like, you know, over 50% of Kenya's population lives more than 1 hour away from, you know, from a, you know, health center. We expected support. We didn't get support from the national level. We do get support at the district level. And the role of the public sector to me, first and foremost, of course, is setting policy, is really to approach the whole needs of the health systems in the country through strategic thinking. Kenya, for example, has been having all these strategic plans for health. We're now into our second strategic plan, I think, you know, over 5-10 years period. And we somehow are coming up with strategic plans without really addressing the strategic needs of the country. So if you look at the strategic plan, it seems as though that it's only the public sector that can address the needs of healthcare in the country. Yet the public sector meets maybe 50% of the needs of the country. So what's happening to the other 50%? So when we went out to set up CFW shops, we find that there's a lot of legal barriers, you know, to setting up a private outlet. You find that for a nurse to have an outlet in the rural area where she's dispensing and treating clients, she needs 10 years post-qualification experience in order to run that business. It doesn't matter where her 10 years of experience is coming from. You know, she could just have been working in some highly specialized area of some hospital, but it's 10 years then you can go and work in the community. So legal barriers, the legal framework, we've had the issues of quality control, I think is something that the public sector should ensure. They've got a regulatory function. They should control the quality of the health workers, control the quality of the products, control and inspect and ensure that, you know, only the people who are qualified deal with these products. Instead, we find drugs in shops. So those are just some of the issues.
Thanks, Lisa. Dan, briefly describe to us what the 50 by 15 initiative is, and in that, also answer the question, why now?
Thank you very much. 50 by 15 is an initiative that we established in Davos in 2005 that basically addressed the fact that the internet is one of the most empowering things that the world has ever seen in education, healthcare, and actually a number of other areas. So 50 by 15 is our long-term commitment to enable half the world with internet access by 2015, and we are actually focusing those activities in the areas of education and healthcare. Why now is an interesting question. I think there's no question in everyone's mind that we've kind of reached a bit of a perfect storm where the cost of internet access, while in many parts of the world is still excessively high, at least access exists. The cost of computing has dropped precipitously and has allowed and enabled new combinations of technologies and things to occur. And we're also getting more adept at being able to get off the grid, which is so essential towards reaching that 50% goal, both with regard to power as well as with regard to the connectivity that's going to become the essential component of that enablement.
Great. Let me ask you a question similar to what I asked Lisa, which is that what do you need from the global health community to succeed? I'm struck that with all this great technological advance and your efforts to increase connectivity, if all we have is a greater opportunity to get spam and look at Facebook, I'm not sure that's worth it. What kind of content do you need from us?
Well, I think it gets pretty interesting in that if technology is applied properly, it actually kind of becomes rather transparent. I think everyone sitting next to me would agree that technology is going to be a tremendous enabler in terms of doing their thing. But it's not just about the hardware. There's a whole ecosystem of needs, and it has to do with everything from the software and the content and the electricity that I described, but also the capacity building of the people to enable and maintain and support these things. The public sector often thinks, again, that computers will just sort of solve the problem. And I think a lot of us went through this about 10 years ago when we airdropped PCs into different environments for healthcare and education and hoped that they would work. 10 years later, we go and visit these same places and the PCs are kind of stacked up and the desktops have become doorstops. What we seek from the public sector is an understanding of the needs to establish all of that as an ecosystem. We all talk about sustainability, but here it really rings true that you need to come up with a system and a plan so that 5 years from now we're not wiping the dust off of things that don't work. And the way that happens is through buy-in, but also through long-term commitments that have monitoring and metrics placed against them to make sure that on a regular basis things aren't falling into disrepair, and then when things need to be improved, they are.
Great. I want to kind of get out of our formal lineup here and just kind of mix it up a bit. The question I want to put now to the panel, and any of you can feel free to respond, is really to go back to Julio's analogy of the black box of health systems and the avoidance some people have of thinking about health systems, right, because the problem is so big. Often when we open up the box, the first light that shines in highlights the problem that's, in fact, outlined on your fact sheets at your table, which is about human resources for health, about the shortage of doctors, about the presumption that doctors or nurses need to provide most of the care. So let me just open it up for your thoughts about human resources and health as one of the important subsystems, if you will, of a health system strengthening challenge.
Well, I think what could say, following on Dan, that you need hardware, software, and humanware. And the fact of the matter is that the health system is at the end, at its core, about the interaction between a group of people who have a health need and another group of people who have the skills and knowledge to try to meet that need. It's the encounter between a confidence of a population and a consciousness on the part of those that provide. And as I said, people are also co-producers of their own health. So everything boils down to that fundamental encounter. It is about people. And I think you ask, Chris, why now? Since 2000, the global health community has made enormous strides in putting health at the center of the development agenda. The level of resources that have been mobilized for global health is unprecedented. We're still falling short from financial need. But the one thing we're discovering is that money, while a very necessary condition, is not sufficient. We need people. We need institutions and organizations. We need the sort of framework where we can analyze the role of the public and the private sector. In my mind, a health system can be analyzed according to the functions that have to be performed. And there are four key functions. Stewardship, giving strategic direction, like you said, and that's primarily a role for the government. Second, financing. And that, again, I believe it is a public responsibility to make sure that no one is left in a position where they either have to choose between paying for care and therefore becoming impoverished for that care or forgoing the care because they can't afford it. So making sure, and that's another public responsibility, that we actually have a system that covers everyone and that no one is forced to become impoverished because of healthcare costs. The third function is the delivery, and that's where the private sector has an enormous, we need to encourage pluralism, we need to encourage the capacity to experiment and to have the great imagination of the private sector. And the fourth function is resource generation, centrally human resources, and again, this is an area for a lot of private participation in the training of doctors and nurses. But let us not forget that at the end of everything, we regulate, we assure quality, we provide mobilized resources, mostly through public or publicly mandated funding. At the end, what matters is that it is all about people. The health system is all about people at the end.
Thank you, Julio. Let me switch to Lisa to kind of go from the macro level to the micro level and have you talk about the community level. We've heard in a number of the other sessions about the role of community health workers. Mm-hmm. I think we have in the old debate about vertical programs, one joke was that ultimately those vertical programs become integrated at the level of the community health worker, who may be a family planning worker on Mondays, work for the leprosy programs on Tuesday mornings, and malaria Tuesday afternoon, give immunizations on Wednesday. Talk about the experience in Kenya with community health workers and in trying to strengthen that delivery system at the community level.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. When you look at the whole issue of human resources also, if I look at it from the Kenyan situation, I know different countries are at different places. We have a situation in Kenya where we have over 10,000 nurses who have been trained and are jobless. On the one hand, we've also lost about 3,000 nurses so far to the UK and to the US to look for greener, pastures. But when you look at the whole issue of human resources, it's that you may have situations where people have been trained, but then you do not have whatever it takes, the incentives needed to enable the private sector or the alternative for these nurses to be employed. Then when we come to the community level, in fact, when we started out, we had, gone through all the work that had been done during the primary healthcare phase of, health systems development, let me say it that way. And so we looked to work with community health workers at the community level. A lot of community health workers have been trained at the community level to do those very basic interventions and to be given that information they need at the community level. They're there. They've been trained. But programs have come up, trained them, and sometimes left them, or trained them as volunteers and not provided them with, the systems to sustain them and keep them going. Again, programs come up and train them depending on, back to the verticalization problem. What is the need right now? Oh, we need home-based care. Okay, let's pull the community health workers. Let's train them on home-based care, What's the need tomorrow? It could be epilepsy. It's something new, hasn't been dealt with. Let's pull the community health workers and let's train them on how to take care of, epileptics in the community. And it just keeps changing. And we just need, some sort of deep, some sort of long-term commitments, because the community health workers are there and they are a very important resource, but they can't be seen as a resource that is sort of picked and dropped, according to what is expedient for the day.
Great. Jim, you had a some thoughts on this, I think.
Well, you know, we've had a long experience utilizing community health workers, even for very complicated interventions. And I think the critical thing that we found, even in the most impoverished settings, Lesotho, rural Haiti, is that there's never a lack of resourceful humans, and often are unemployed. We found that paid community health worker programs that really focus on integrating the workers with an existing health delivery system that provides a broader range of services is really critical. And I think what Lisa says is true. Some flavor of the month is, you know, rolled out, and they train them for a while and don't train them for a while. You know, I think if you try to do a real hard-headed analysis of how you, to use Mike Porter's language, create value in a health system and follow it along, you'll find that so many of the points in which you're trying to do healthcare interventions don't require a medical degree. And that's a problem that we have to fix in the United States. We're not even very good at doing that in the United States. Some of the healthcare systems like Kaiser and others have really done that, have done task shifting is what the new term is called. So, again, I think what's needed is a whole bunch of new people who are looking at the details of these sort of unsexy issues of implementation and delivery. Lisa's experience, the thing I worry about is it sounds like a wonderful experience, but unless we have people out there who are trying to actively capture it, think about what the lessons are, and then elaborate that into analytic frameworks and underlying principles, then we're going to lose it because we've lost so many wonderful little innovations over the years. There are tremendous numbers of little cottage industries that are doing great things, and we're losing them every single day. So I think it has to be a new field, and I think it would be what we hope would look at delivery issues and make them sexy. We hope to try to do that because that's what we need. We need the smartest people in the world to think about those issues on a daily basis.
Great, thanks, Jim. Dan, you want to add to this? The question I was going to ask you, maybe you can incorporate it in your answer, is if we think at the community level, what are some of the leapfrog technologies? Give us the vision of that community health worker and what kind of device is she holding, and how's that going to enable her to do much better than she's done historically?
Sure. I think I mentioned before the notion of transparency. For those of you that have read the book Giving already, on page 35 or so, they talk about Rinkwavu Hospital in Rwanda, and I had the chance to spend some time there over the summer. And there they have a company of tours who are largely women who have 4 to 5 HIV/AIDS patients that they take care of. And then they report in by walking several miles, sometimes 10 miles, in to provide the reports in to the hospital or the clinic to say, this is the condition of my patient. And then if the condition is not good, then it requires, obviously, a return journey back and forth. As part of the overall delivery system, again, as part of a really synchronized system, we see leapfrog technologies for these care workers as offering even some of the most simple tools in the form of cell phones and in some cases other wireless devices, depending on the environment, that allow them, even without having to type a single letter, to be able to respond with regard to the condition of the patients under their care, to request additional services, and to back to your human resource question, actually allow them to potentially handle more patients because they're spending less time coming in and going out, and they're spending more time in the communities where they can do the most good. Some of these things are just simple, you know, literally graphical displays with no text on them at all. Some of them will actually have pictures of the patients so that they know that they're reporting on simple patient things with simple numerical answers. These are, you know, just small examples, but again, we're looking at integrating a lot of them in it, and it's really the toolbox that we choose from and how we put it all together and how we try to make the technology disappear so that they're just doing their job, and that all that information then, of course, once it's electronic, becomes something that becomes part of a much larger record that can show trends and problems and areas where there's concern on a much larger basis. And, you know, once you've got that data in, as we were discussing earlier today, you can do all kinds of things with it that can help.
Great. We just have 2 minutes left, so I want to make a summary comment that brings together some of the things we've heard in previous sessions at the meeting. And then I'm going to ask each of you to just say 15, 20 seconds what you think is one of the key things you want the tables to be discussing as we go into the next session. As I've sat through the last 4 global health sessions, I'm struck that we live in some ways in the best of times and in the worst of times. The best of times is that we have an incredible wealth of new innovation coming. We heard that this morning in the drug resistance panel, yesterday in the vaccines and immunizations panel. There are incredible, unprecedented investments in global health. Compared to a decade ago when we talked about millions of dollars of investment, today we're talking about billions of dollars of investment. A lot of that has gone into development of new tools and technologies. And the danger, I think, the worst of times, the threat to our success, is that we've yet to put in the same intelligence, resources, and creativity into the health systems challenge. And as a consequence, we face the danger of a pileup of this innovation. If that happens, the public-private partnerships that we're currently working in to develop a lot of those new tools are going to go away. Because if we develop a new vaccine for malaria or something and we don't use it, we can't get it into the health system because the health system doesn't have the people or the money or the logistics and supply chain. People who are currently incenting on the margin to work with us aren't going to keep doing that. So the health system's challenges, I would submit, is the Achilles heel of the current global health program, and that we need to address that. And so with that as a frame for your discussions at your tables, let me just quickly see what comments our panelists want to give you to launch you. Julio?
Well, I think a key question today, a key challenge, is we are indeed seeing more and more technologies available, but not every country has developed the social instrumentalities to make sure that people have the access and do so without incurring in what one could call the unacceptable paradox that we're living today. Health is one of the most potent means we have to empower people to lift themselves out of poverty. But a very large and growing number of people become impoverished because they need to pay for their own health care because we haven't created the social protection mechanisms, whether it's conditional cash transfers or whether it's free delivery of services, even with all the problems that may entail, or forms like the one we introduced in Mexico of people's health insurance, insurance for the unemployed, for the self-employed, for the peasants, or, depending on the circumstances, form of social insurance. But there's a menu of choices, and the fact is that WHO estimates 100 million families in the world today that every year become impoverished because they pay for their own health care. And it's happening in the poorest communities, people who will sell everything, their livestock, their tools. We need to think of ways of making these magic bullets be part of a magic gun and make sure that we have human resources that pull the trigger accurately and aim it to where it has to go. But if we don't empower people with the rest of the social instrumentalities, we're just creating either paradoxes or a lot of social frustration.
Okay. Jim, 20 seconds.
So I don't like the gun analogy too much, but I think that an opportunity for public and private cooperation is in doing some fundamental things that they do in every single other field and in every other business that we're not doing in global health. We're not capturing experience. We're not capturing innovation as it happens. We're not taking those innovations and comparing them and coming up with analytic frameworks and fundamental principles. And then we're not coming up with mechanisms to spread those innovations across the world. These are very basic human functions because from the beginning of time, our task has been how do you get groups of people to do things that they wouldn't normally do? That's the task in global health. And I think it's time that we could come up with a whole new field. Global health delivery science, Mike Porter calls it, that would bring the private and the public sector and the universities together to truly create systems that will transform implementation and practice in every country. I think that it's time for that. Or I worry that the technology pileup, as Chris calls it, and as the implementation bottleneck, as I've called it, is going to lead to tremendous frustration, and the money for global health is going to dry up.
Lisa, 20 seconds.
How can private sector be incentivized to bring their range of skills and experience to improving delivery systems to reach the poorest of the poor?
Thank you. Dan?
Well, I think very much I agree with Jim's comment. Believe it or not, there's a relationship between architecture and health, only in my mind, in that there's been something recently created called the Open Architecture Network, which is designed to actually bring together a open global network of people to be able to work on these things together and to publish their results in the public domain so that everybody can use them. There are certainly fledgling efforts like that in healthcare delivery, but I think it could be exponentially more valuable if we really put the right resources behind that type of activity.
Right. Thank you. Daniel Stone's going to tell us our instructions for the next part of this session.
All right, thanks very much. So we've heard from the stage here a lot of great ideas and great strategies that are already being put into place in different areas. It's now time to turn to you folks to see what ideas you have for what can be done to strengthen the health delivery systems. And there are three different kinds of things that come to mind here. One is you have a number of ideas that are being done here on certain scales. Are there ideas for scaling those up, for getting even more application of those at broader levels? Are there ideas that have not been considered here that you think ought to be tried out for strengthening health delivery systems? And are there ideas that you might want to borrow from other fields of activity or endeavor and apply them in the context of public health delivery systems? So what we're going to ask you to do for the next 25 minutes is engage in a conversation at your table. And again, what we'd like you to do is try to come up with two or three ideas for actions that can be taken that would have a significant impact on strengthening healthcare delivery systems. And as you think about these ideas, think about who should be involved in them and what would be concrete next steps to be taken in order to move into action. So you've got 25 minutes. Have a great conversation, and we will be back.